Today on Movie World, as we continue our coverage of Tribeca 2017. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Rollers is your daily dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter from the Tribeca Film Festival 2017. And I say that because it's got a slightly different intro today because we're pretty much covering, hopefully, we're going to try and do daily podcasts here from Tribeca. And we had another movie-filled day of festing here.
Yes, including dumplings and donuts.
Well, actually, it's kind of cool. This year's film festival is coming from Chelsea. So in the years past, the screenings have been done down at the Regal in Battery Park, which is a lovely theatre. But Chelsea, this is at the Cinépolis in Chelsea on 27th Street, 23rd Street of New York. And there just seem to be an infinite variety of edibles around, including, yes, a shout out to Excellent Dumplings.
Which were excellent, by the way.
Yes.
That's, you know, it's difficult if you call yourself excellent anything.
Yes, that's an expectation. Yeah, very high. But they were.
They truly were. So Excellent Dumplings were truly magnificent.
And we've had our share of dumplings, I should
say. My God, we love dumplings.
Yeah.
We could actually be dumpling wallahs, is what we joke about.
We do like
even some of us look like dumplings.
Yes, but Excellent Dumplings, right on 24th, right?
Yes.
23rd Street, I think. Yeah, same street as the movie theater, but
yes.
24th and 6th, I think it was.
Yes, and a nice little pick-me-up at Donut Planet. Yes.
We don't talk also, about that on the podcast.
Also on 23rd.
My cardiologist might be listening.
Yes, and I don't like donuts, but these were delicious.
And here's a segue. Donuts make you thirsty. And our first movie is?
Well, yeah, so we have 9 movies to talk about. So yes, Thirst Street, I guess, is the first of them. And I think
I have the intro.
Rashmi, you're going to tell us all about
Thirst
Street.
I am. And this is actually one I wanted to watch. But as I said on yesterday's podcast, I really wanted to watch my friend Dharma. And so this one went head to head with that. So I know the two of you went to see that. And this is Gina, an American flight attendant, falls in love with a Parisian bartender on a layover only to find herself tangled in a web of deception, delusion, and unrequited amour fou. So this is directed by Nathan Silver and written by Nathan Silver and C. Mason Wells. And it's got a quite good cast, I'd say. Angelica Houston, Lindsay Burge, Lola Bessis, Alista, I'm not even going to pronounce that name, Damien Bernard, and a whole host of others. So, Joe and Yazdi, what did you think of this?
Go for it, Yazdi.
Oh, I see that look.
It's quite something. I haven't seen anything like it during this year's film festival. This movie is just completely drunk. It's drunk in the late 70s kind of sort of filmmaking. In fact, it's not into like the last third of the movie that somebody removes an iPhone and I realize, oh, this movie is actually not set in the 70s because it has that, that faded yellowish tint of filmmaking. The soundtrack is completely from this. I mean, it's got a very unusual soundtrack. Like I would say even earlier, like old musicals kind of soundtrack. And it's, I don't know. I mean, part of it wants to be like a Wes Anderson movie. It's so stylized.
Ooh.
Part of it wants to be kind of these, you know, late 70s movies, like kind of these, you know, woman obsessed kind of movies. But it's quite its own beast. I don't know if I love the movie, but I really am happy that I got to watch it. And maybe happy is too far. I'm glad that I watched it.
Okay.
I wasn't happy.
And is there a lot of it in Paris? Because I love Paris.
It's all in Paris.
It's all set in Paris. And it's all shot in Paris as far as I can tell. Yes. It's not some, studio backdrop. There's a reason I let Yazdi go first with that. Because this movie is incredibly difficult to sum up. And I'm really glad he did a really good job there of trying to synthesize what it was that we saw. So, you know, it's like Yazdi said, it's kind of a fever dream of a movie. It's very, very, it's very hard to kind of, It's more about a feeling than a narrative, although the narrative is definitely there. This is somebody, I think, who is really throwing the kitchen sink of ideas at a plot. And so I think the ideas are stronger than the plot in many ways, but, you know, it kind of comes across as being this kind of trippy experience. The soundtrack, as you mentioned, Yazdi, has this, I kind of read kind of 80s synthesizer type feel rather than 70s, but it did have the kind of the femme.
Yeah, it sounds like
the femme scorned
thriller
feel of the
noir-ish.
It was. I mean, you know, in essence, it's an unreturned love type story. The woman, and I think that's kind of what confused me more than anything else. The plot elements were very, you know, there's a lot of things thrown in there. So, you know, the woman has a past, you know, kind of a sad past. She falls in love, and then it kind of goes through a variety of different ups and downs. So, you know, it's trippy. In fact, one of the things I pointed out to Yazdi just as we were leaving was the credits, the credit rolls. They had this idea of kind of flipping them around. So, you know, they go at 45 degrees angles and then they bounce across to the other 45 degrees. I mean, there's just a lot of things thrown in there. A lot of good ideas. And I think it's a potential filmmaker talent to watch. You know, I'd be interested to see, you know, what this group of people come up with next.
Yeah, I think what the other thing which makes this movie rather notable is the fact that even as stylized and as, you know, as dreamy as it is, and it's very dreamy to the extent that I don't think they even ever wanted this to be remotely realistic. I mean, it's as far away from naturalistic as it might get, as one might get. But I think it kind of really captures this feeling of what it means to demean yourself and degrade yourself when you're in love. And I think the last time I'd seen something get that sore and that raw was in something like Blue is the Warmest Color. But, you know, here it's really hard to watch this character kind of, you know, she's unable to take no for an answer. And she just keeps, you know, further and further demeaning herself.
Yeah.
You know, for the affections of somebody who doesn't love her. And it's just very hard to watch. And, okay. And I think therein, it kind of has a dark humor which goes along with it. So it's quite a unique thing.
Yeah.
And I guess it probably taps into that feeling of unrequited love that, you know, everyone experiences at some point in their life.
Yeah, no.
Where, you know, you feel affection for someone and it's not returned.
I tell you what was not unrequited. Conjunctivitis.
Yeah.
This movie had a really bizarre little kind of STD moment where conjunctivitis is passed around rather than something more ominous. But it was such an odd thing to kind of throw in there because I felt they could have done more.
The pink eye.
Yeah, yeah, it was quite funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're moving on.
Indeed. What's our next movie?
My Friend Dahmer.
Okay, so...
So, My Friend Dahmer is directed by Mark Myers, and the description is as follows, that before Jeffrey Dahmer became one of the most notorious serial killers of all time, he was a teenage loner. Conducting grisly experiments in a makeshift backyard lab, Jeff was invisible to most until his increasingly bizarre behavior unexpectedly attracted friends. So, this is based on the cult graphic novel My Friend Dahmer, and it chronicles the origins of the man, the monster, the high school senior. So I guess this movie kind of looks at, you know, what Dahmer might have been when he was much younger and before he, I guess, went completely off the rails. And Rashmi, you saw this. So
yeah, so I was
it.
Pretty obsessed with trying to watch this. You know, I think I have an unhealthy obsession with serial killers, mainly because I like to try and understand people. And I think the question that haunts all of us when we hear about these serial killers is this nature or nurture? Is this something to do with their environment or is this just the way that they're born? And so this movie does a very good job of chronicling or biopicking Jeffrey Dahmer's life in his teenage years, through his high school years. And it's only a couple of years before he makes his first human kill. I think the movie rests on the shoulders of Ross Lynch, who's actually a Disney star who plays Dahmer. And he is exceptional. I mean, I've watched a lot of footage of Jeffrey Dahmer. He captured the essence of Jeffrey Dahmer so well. And he's covering him as a teenager. I think my one criticism of the movie is it's a little bit too long. It could have definitely have been a bit tighter. And I think I was looking for a bit more of an emotional connection, but maybe that's intentional because Dharma was unable to have emotional connections with people and found it so hard. But overall, it's a really well-made movie. Production is excellent. It really does a good job, and I never thought I would feel this way, of almost making you feel sorry for Jeffrey Dahmer. I mean, one should never have empathy with a killer, but I guess what you do start to understand is that his parents really screwed him up a little bit, and there's some inferences to the fact that maybe his mom was taking certain pills when she was pregnant with him, or, you know, she was a little bit crazy herself. There was a lot of repressed homosexuality when he's growing up.
That's a sign of a well-constructed narrative. I mean, I think, you know, whenever you're sympathetic to the central character, you know, despite the horrors of what he ended up doing, I think, you know, helping us understand who he might be. And, you know, does the movie kind of get into the nature versus nurture aspect of it? I mean, was he made, or was he just strange to start with?
I think he was strange to start with. I think a lot of it is nature, but I think nurture didn't help. So I think...
Right, so it's a combination of environmental factors and certain traits.
Somewhat. So I think that he had an unhealthy fascination with, you know, the insides of animals. And what's to say that if his parents hadn't let him continue that he maybe wouldn't have gone the human route. But I think the other thing is that there was a lot of repressed homosexuality as well. And so now you're playing with this morbid fascination of the insides of living things, as well as... a high from, you know, finding other men to be with, or that realization that he liked men more than he liked women. Very good movie. Like I said, runs a little bit long, exceptional acting, and actually based on a book, like you said, Yazdi, from a friend of his from school, who is another central character. So I would highly recommend this one.
Terrific.
Very good.
Okay, so the next one is 1% More Humid, and I'm doing this one, but I am not organized.
Well, if you're looking for it in the book, it is on page 27, so check it out. And I guess just while you're looking for it, so I'm the only one that actually saw this one.
Yeah,
this was.
I really wanted to see this one because it's got a great cast.
It has, yes.
Is this the one with
Maggie Siff, Juno Temple?
Right.
Yes, Julia Garner, Alessandra Nivola. Garner, yeah. Okay, so I am now ready. Thank you. A pair of childhood friends reunite during their summer break from college and deal with a traumatizing experience from their past. This one looked very good, directed and written by Liz Garcia.
Yeah, so I'm the only one that saw this, and you know, essentially this is a coming of age story. It's I won't say it's a sexual awakening, because I think the story starts with these girls already awakened in many ways, but it's set against the backdrop of kind of a tragedy, and so, you know, they've been through a traumatic experience, and they get together in this small town. Essentially to heal. You know, they lost a friend in a car accident as kind of the setting of the backdrop of the movie. And so, you know, it felt initially very slow. This movie takes its time to get to where it's going. You know, no one's ever going to accuse it of being rushed, and I don't actually mean that in a mean way. You know, that's not like a cloaked way of saying this movie was too slow. It wasn't. It just takes its time to get to where it's going. And you know, it's set against this beautiful backdrop. It's exquisitely shot and lit. I mean, the one thing that this movie plays with forever, it feels like they only ever shot during dawn or dusk. I mean, everything is bathed in this beautiful golden sunlight. But essentially, you know, it follows Juno Temple really as the main person in the story. You know, she does end up, you know, going through this kind of, I don't want to give too much away about the plot here, but, you know, she does get involved with somebody in the movie, and it becomes a very intense, you know, passionate relationship. It's not without complications. So, you know, that's part of what they're dealing with in this movie. Her friend, on the other hand, also goes down kind of a different route, but also trying to mask, I think, some of their pain by essentially getting involved with men in a sexual way. And you know, the movie works very well. I mean, I think.
Is it sleazy? Is it lurid?
It's not so much, but it's very intense. Okay. So, you know, is it graphic? No. I think Juno Temple probably has a no nipple clause in her contract. So make of that what you will. But it doesn't mean to say that the scenes aren't intense. And I think they're very passionate, very intense. And both young leads have superb performances here. And I think the main male character as well, I forget who he's played by, but he does a terrific job here of being a guy in conflict.
So is it similar to AWOL that we saw last year with Lola Kirk? It sounds similar.
So there are similarities. I won't say that the movies are similar in any way. That's tangible. But
okay.
Sure, yeah, the small town America type setting, yeah. the girls of a certain age getting involved romantically and sexually with people. But more than anything, I think this movie is kind of about a feeling.
Okay.
It captures that time of life very well, when you know feelings are very strong, and you know it is set against this background of tragedy that the girls are kind of coping with as kind of a catalyst to some of the behaviors that ultimately present. So you know, it's a very good film. The cast did a sterling job. I think it was well written, very well directed, you know, just check it out if you get the chance to see it. Just know that you'll need to give it time to kind of get to where it's going.
To build, yeah.
Yeah, and interesting. Isn't Juno Temple, she's doing more, didn't she write Juno? No,
that was Ellen, no, not Ellen Page. Ellen Page was in Juno, but that was Diablo Cody,
yeah. That's right.
Juno
that's
Temple right. was in that movie with Matthew McConaughey.
That's
Killer
right.
Joe.
That's right.
Killer Joe, yeah.
That's right, okay. Total brain.
But she's a fine young actress. And
she is.
And the other one's on Game of Thrones, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't follow Julia Game of Garner, Thrones, but yeah. Both leads were terrific. I think they had. It's kind of one of those movies that's a little bit of a gem for an actor, because they get to show a lot of different facets. So both of them did you know tremendous work here, and yeah.
Yeah, Juno Temple was in Sin City. That's the other one. That's where else we know
that's
her
from. Right.
Yeah, she's been in a lot of things.
Yeah. Okay, so next one is Sweet Virginia, Yazdi, which you saw.
And I am going to introduce, so bear with me while I flip to page 79 in my Tribeca guide. But this was a movie that
flipping here, flipping there, there's iPads everywhere and telephones. And
it's funny, actually, as we do these live podcasts, we really are working on the fly here. It's a pretty busy day at Tribeca, including the dumpling eating. So when we get back to our hotel, it's like chaos as we try to synthesize all of our thoughts of the day. But I found the page. So Sweet Virginia, this is part of the spotlight narrative here at the festival, and this was one that I actually was conflicted, because it was scheduled against 1% More Humid, and so I figured let Yes to go see this one and I'll go see the other one. But it's directed by Jamie M. Dagg, with a screenwriter credited as the China Brothers. I'm not quite sure what that means. But a burglary homicide rattles the residents of a small Alaska town in particular. Two women made widows by the crime and their mutual friend Sam. Sam is an outsider himself, a former radio champ who is also all too happy to leave the jolt and violence of the ring behind. So, terrific cast in this. I mean, I see Rosemary DeWitt, Imogen Poots, John Bernthal, and Christopher Abbott. And one of the things that really attracted me to this was in the description. It says it was a nitty-gritty neo-Western with echoes of early Coen brothers. So, Yazdi, tell us about Sweet Virginia.
Gosh, until you mentioned Coen brothers just like 2 seconds ago, I wouldn't have even thought, but it's just absolutely the most apt thing to say. It's very reminiscent of Blood Simple, you know, which put the Coen brothers on the map, I think. But, you know... Yesterday amongst the three of us, we watched 9 movies. Today amongst the three of us, we watched 9 movies. And my favorite yesterday was Flower. And today, by a wide, wide, wide margin, this was my favorite movie that I watched today, Sweet Virginia. It's just such a confident piece of work. It's very Americana in that it's set in this small town. But there is so much control over this material, and it's just so deliciously tense. I mean, the whole movie has this sense of foreboding. And to the movie's great credit, you know most of the things. I mean, you know, it doesn't hold things. I mean, and actually, the movie has, I think, two very, very unexpected reveals, but they both come within the first 20 minutes where you're like, you go like that. And then it kind of, you know who all the players are, but,
right.
But it's how it is structured and how these different characters react with each other. And they're so wonderfully realized, and nobody is perfect. Everybody has their flaws. And at its core, it's about a crime gone horribly wrong, but it's not a criminal movie at all. It's all about human behavior.
Right.
And it's about how, one person trying to save themselves does certain thing which impacts somebody else. And then that person has a secret and it comes around. And it's just beautifully. I mean, the movie is just one piece after the other, which is a, like almost a masterclass in building suspense. You know, think about No Country for Old Men or Blood Simple or whatever. I mean, there's this incredible car scene in the middle of the movie, which is so beautifully played. And you know, for a movie called Sweet Virginia, you almost expect it to be this saccharine movie. And there's nothing sweet about this movie
at all. Or a Reese Witherspoon popping up somewhere.
It's not. It's actually very dark, slow build, tense movie. But it's polished. It's beautifully written. Wonderfully acted. Rosemary DeWitt has a difficult role, and she's great. Imogen
Poots.
She's
always great.
She has a, quite difficult role. And Imogen Poots, who's been around for a long time,
she has one of the best names ever, by the way.
I would change Poots. But anyway, she has a central role. But I think this movie is kind of, and John Bernthal plays the lead, and you know, he's very good here. But the one person who really, I think, walks away with the movie is Christopher Abbott. And I don't know if you remember Christopher Abbott. I think he originally started in Girls. He was in, he was in so many movies last year. He plays kind of the role which would have normally gone to Shia LaBeouf.
Mm-hmm.
He plays this kind of sleazy kind of... no gooder who's out to, he's just so effortlessly creepy. And, he's a fine, fine actor. He was in Hello, I Must Be Going. He was in, he was in A Most Violent Year. He was in James White last year.
Oh.
Remember? That brilliant movie. And I think Christopher Abbott is a great actor. He was in Whiskey, Foxtrot, Tango, whatever. He's been in so many movies, but here he just plays a great baddie. He just, really runs away with the movie. I cannot recommend this movie enough.
I hope it gets a release.
This is second time out for that director, which is interesting. So as I'm reading the Tribeca material here, his first feature was awarded the first time filmmaker award at the Toronto Film Festival in 2015, a movie called River. So this is his second time out. Clearly we've got some talent
really knows what they're doing. It's just, polished, it's confident, and it's so deliciously tense. I mean, I was just on the edge of my seat the whole time. And you can almost write this away as another movie about a bad crime scene in small town America, but it's really accomplished. Do check it out.
Terrific.
Sweet Virginia. And it's called Sweet Virginia because that's the name of the motel that the lead character owns. And a lot of the characters kind of revolve around that motel.
Terrific.
So Sweet Virginia. Do check it out.
Okay. Our next movie then, I guess, Rashmi, on your list is Shadow Man.
It is.
And...
Yeah,
Yasti, you want to take this one away?
Allow me to introduce Shadow Man. Shadow Man is a documentary which was directed by Oren Jacoby. And why does his name sounds familiar? But the description is that in the early 1980s, Richard Hambleton was New York City's precursor to Banksy, who, of course, as we know, is a rogue street artist whose silhouette paintings haunted the sides of Manhattan buildings. Like so many other geniuses of his time, Hambleton fell victim to drug addiction, even as his work continued to rise in both demand and value. And Shadow Man doubles as both a time capsule of a forgotten New York City era and a redemption story. So I know, Rashmi, you have quite an obsession.
Well, I was going to say, before you get into that, this movie did look very interesting to me, but I couldn't help but feel that the name Banksy is thrown around at the merest mention because he has such a strong fan following. Rashmi, you're in that fan club,
correct?
So I was kind of a little off put that they might just throw that word in there to kind of attract people to the movie. But
and remember last year they had the movie called The Banksy Job, which had nothing to do with Banksy,
correct.
Or not
which
directly.
Actually, by the way, is just getting a release this year.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, so tell us about Shadow Man.
Yeah, so this is the first doc that I got to watch, so I was super excited to watch a documentary because I always associate film festivals with good documentary, and I hadn't got to see one yet. Okay, I'm so happy I went to see this. And you're right, Joe, you know, the mere mention of the word Banksy will have me running anywhere around the country, indeed the globe.
A little bit of Banksy baiting.
Bit of Banksy, yeah, I'm a Banksy baiterette. anyway, so the good news is that although Banksy is mentioned, this story is standalone, is super interesting. Richard Hambleton is basically described as the founder of the street art movement. He basically was Banksy before Banksy became anything. And there's actually a mention from someone who knows Banksy that says that Banksy was actually heavily influenced by Richard Hambleton. More than anything, I think you're right, Yazdi, in your intro, you mentioned that although this is a story about this guy, Richard Hambleton, this is actually a story about New York City. This is as much about New York City and the art scene within New York City as it is about this guy. The interesting thing about this guy, however, is that he became famous for doing these shadows of people around New York City. And that's why it's called Shadow Man.
Right.
But it's also Shadow Man in the sense of the man becomes a shadow of himself. He's kind of one of these very charming, could be on the cover of GQ in the 80s, high living, highfalutin', people who kind of got, you know, made a name for himself in the art world in the 80s, along with Andy Warhol. But he was at the same time as Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat,
mm-hmm.
both of who passed away, unfortunately. This is really a rags to riches to rags story. And that's what I think is the genius. You can hear all the traffic in the background. That's unusual for us, isn't it? But there's one line in this movie that really captured me. And it's basically where he's looking back on his life now because he's quite sick. And many people have tried to help him. But the issue is that he's a huge junkie. So two things here. One is there's a great line in the movie that says, at least when Jean Basquiat died, he died. I was still alive when I died.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a telling right. piece, I think, about, you know, what he's gone through.
Does it refer to, you know, Banksy at all in terms of
no.
kind of the baton being passed
no.
on?
At all? No, okay. no. I mean, really, the only thing it mentions is that this guy was the founder of proper street art, not graffiti, of street art.
Right.
And has a very interesting, unique perspective on how street art should be enjoyed. And if you recall, people like Keith Haring and him ended up making money. You know, they ended up becoming so famous from their street art that they became part of the art scene.
Right.
And so it's this pollution of what is street art and how do we value art? And Joe, you and I talk about this all the time because we talk about Banksy a lot. But, you know, yeah, how
what's
do
the
you
inherent,
value?
What,
how
what's do you the inherent value
on someone's
of
drawing?
Art?
And, you know, the fact that they're living or dead changes that value. So three lessons, you know, geniuses are fascinating and they're very, very clever. Talented junkies get screwed and the art world is bullshit. That's the three things I picked up. So again, brilliant documentary. If you like anything about New York City in the 80s, if you like anything to do with street art or graffiti or just these incredible stories about people who are almost broken because they're geniuses. Like geniuses mm-hmm. have something almost, I think, broken in their head. Yes, so we were talking about that movie, The Change.
And also the Einstein
movie. And the autism.
Movie.
Yeah, and that spectrum of autism. I mean, this is a man who's broken and nothing can save him. Brilliant,
like,
brilliant documentary.
Sounds great.
Okay, the next one we have on our list is AlphaGo. And I was kind of interested to see this, but Joe, I was excited that you went to see this because this is basically about artificial intelligence, but it's more around the fact that the ancient Chinese board game Go, which I've never even heard of, has long been considered the holy grail for artificial intelligence. So it's a doc, and I know both of you got to see this. So am I sad I missed it?
Well, yes, you are. And I think you should be, because, anyone that knows me knows that I'm a geek, and that I really should have done computer science with my life rather than anything else.
What, you mean you don't?
Well,
no. Professionally.
Yeah, professionally, okay, yeah. We walk around the house and there's bits of computer everywhere.
Indeed. But this movie is on a topic that I found fascinating, the development of AI, artificial intelligence. And, you know, it's really been the holy grail for as long as computing has been in existence. Like, when will computers become sufficiently sophisticated and powerful that they could perhaps outdo the best human minds? And, you know, we saw that back in the 80s, I think, with the chess battles, where, you know, eventually computers were able to be sophisticated enough that they could beat humans in chess, even the best humans. But in this movie, we talk about a game called Go, which is apparently a very old board game. I'm not very familiar with it. I learned more today about Go than I'd ever knew in my life. But Go is an infinitely complex game. It's very simple in its structure, but almost infinitely difficult in terms of mastery, because there are so many options at any point in time in the game that, you know, there are people who dedicate their lives to the mastery of this. And Google, or rather a company called DeepMind, which was acquired by Google, has taken on the task of trying to beat Go, the world's best human players, with artificial intelligence algorithms. So the movie's set up very much like a sports movie. It does that kind of very exciting, you know, here are the competitors build up type thing. It follows the pattern of many documentaries that we've seen. I mean, I'm a kind of a junkie for this stuff anyway. You know, there's some very abstract sport that I was watching just on Netflix very recently, but it was set up in kind of a sports documentary style. Table tennis, not abstract, but it was table tennis. It was, but it was one of the most exciting documentaries that I'd seen in a long time.
Oh my God.
And so, you know, this is done in that same kind of manner, but I thought this was a terrific, exciting, punchy, energetic, entertaining narrative. And, you know, I think I wish it'd gone maybe a little bit deeper into the code and the algorithms, but I think, nonetheless, I think it was...
Yasti, do you agree with that?
No, I don't think...
yeah, I was going to say, I saw Yasti kind of like switching off then when
yeah, the
you started talking
like,
about...
How does this stuff work?
Yeah, you know? Oh, let's have a documentary about algorithms.
No, okay, I'm the opposite of Joe. I mean, I don't know much about code, and I, you know, all computers are... anything else, but I still think this is a great documentary because it plays like a great thriller.
Oh.
It really does, because it and you know it's based on real events. And I think it what makes it fascinating is two things. I mean, Joe referred to this. I didn't know that Go is, you know, the most complicated board game in terms of, you know, strategic, you know, how you have to think strategically. And it's so complicated that, several people mentioned this, even the world's masters in Go, at some point, just do it by instinct, because there's so many options that too early in the game, you don't have the mental capacity to figure out where you can go. So initially, you just go by instinct. And it's how you play it is very simple. And I thought that, you know, chess... nothing would ever beat chess in terms of being more strategic, but it turns out this one is far more strategic than that. And even in chess, you know, each piece has a certain number of movements that it can make. And so, you know, on a computer, you can replicate that, but it's very difficult to replicate Go. And so therefore, this kind of sets up the perfect platform to test this eternal question between man versus machine. Mm. You know, can you impart man-like properties on a machine? And the best way to do it is to see if you can develop a machine which can play man in this game, which is known to need the most manpower, the most instinct, if you will.
Yeah.
And it really pits the first time this software, or, you know, the software, they keep trying to update it and make it learn and make it more intelligent. And, you know, it plays out against the world's topmost Go player, who is almost this superstar in Korea and world known. And, you know, he's so cocky, and he comes out and says, well, you know, ha ha ha, I'm playing against a computer program. Of course I will prevail. And you know, it's constructed so beautifully because you watch him playing and you can watch the coming down or this person being undone on camera because he cannot believe that this computer is more intelligent than he is. So it's very well put together and it's quite fascinating.
So I just went on the wiki page for the game Go and it looks like just black and white counters and almost just a grid.
Yes,
that's all.
It was invented more than 2,500 years ago.
In China, yeah.
A casual game is 20 to 90 minutes, but a tournament can last 1 to 6 hours.
Yeah. The thing about the game is its simplicity and sophistication, and it does that marvelous thing of being, again, very simple to pick up, because I think I understand roughly how the game works without having played it, just done a short introduction in the documentary, but the fact that it has, you know, the way, and this is what was fascinating about the DeepMind project, is that chess games were essentially programmed with computers because there are only so many options on an 8x8 chessboard with the type of pieces that you have. And so the way that computers got good at that was they would simply do modeling. They would figure out every single possibility, which one was the optimal one, and then play that move. Whereas with Go, the most powerful computers in the world would take years to calculate all of the possibilities. It's pretty much infinite for all practical purposes. So you have to play intelligently. Mm. And that's a very hard thing for a computer to do because it can't use prediction to figure out how to defeat the opponent. Yeah. It has to outsmart the opponent, which is a very different set of things altogether.
Right. How interesting. Okay, I'm going to try and catch this one if it's on again.
Oh, no, for sure. Yeah, this is the one I'd be happy to watch
again.
And
it's zippy. It moves along very fast.
Okay, next one is Handmaid's Tale.
So I'm so glad that somebody's making a film
version.
It's
another Tribeca TV.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, there was a time in my life when I'd read, you know, all of Margaret Atwood's novels, and she writes incredible dystopian, beautiful political stuff, which is still excellent, you know, just excellent as fiction by itself. And one of her most famous books is The Handmaid's Tale. And it's a story which is so complex and so pertinent to what's going on right now. I think most people have shied away from it because I don't think a two-hour film would ever do justice to it. So I'm so happy that they're actually making a televised version of it. And I guess the pilot of that was shown at Tribeca. And, you know, again, based on Margaret Atwood's acclaimed novel, The Handmaid's Tale, it's the story of Gilead, which is a modern-day totalitarian society, which is facing environmental disasters and a plunging birth rate. And as such, is ruled by a fundamentalist regime that treats women as property. And as one of the very few fertile women left on the planet, Offred, the lead character, is forced into sexual servitude in a desperate attempt to repopulate the world. And in a society where one wrong word could end her life, Offred has only one goal: to survive and to find the daughter who was forcibly taken away from her. So it's really a brilliant story. It speaks about feminism. It speaks about totalitarianism. It speaks about women's choice. It's everything. And so I'm very anxious to know how the pilot was, because it's got a great cast. It's got Alexis Bledel. It's got Bledel. It's got
Elizabeth Moss.
Elizabeth Moss. It's got, you know, Joseph Fine. So tell us.
Yeah, so again, you know, we're movie wallers, we're not TV wallers, but the cast here really caught my attention, and I fit in with the timing. So this is what I wrote down, and I hadn't read the description, Yazdi, but I have started to hear a lot of buzz about this. It's actually being done by Hulu, which is interesting, right? Because we've been watching a lot of Amazon Prime and Netflix. And this is, you know, Hulu Presents.
So this is part of Hulu's original content that they're putting out. Interesting.
Correct. And, you know, it's the pilot. So it's, I don't know how many episodes this is going to be. This is incredible. And in my notes, like I said, I didn't read much about the description. I'd written down, if the extreme Tea Party took over and we had a police state.
Right. Oh, wow.
Imagine what would happen. That's this movie. So, you know, it's kind of interesting because it flits between kind of modern day and then this almost like an Amish type living.
Okay.
Production. So we've gone back to old values. And that's really what I got from it. But it looks really interesting. It's very intriguing. I want to see more.
Elizabeth Moss seems to be the perfect cast for this. I mean, is she?
She's incredible.
She has this diverse range of a very feminine sensibility. She's very strong.
Yes, I was going to use exactly the same word. Yeah, and she can play period, but she's also playing modern.
Right.
Right, because she's having to play almost like an Amish-type woman in Amish-type, you know, conservative dress. And then she's also, you're also seeing her as a modern-day mother. And yeah, very interesting. I really want to. Do we have Hulu?
We don't, but that's easily fixed when I cancel Time Warner Cable for the grief that they keep putting us through. I'll spare our listeners the latest episode of my dissatisfaction with Time Warner Cable, but I think Hulu's the way to go.
Yeah.
Part of our broadcast not brought to you by Time Warner Cable.
And don't believe anything they say when they say they're rebranded as Spectrum. It's the same monkeys at the helm. So.
Yeah, so this is very interesting. And like you said, Yazdi, I mean, this is perfect timing for that whole feeling of, you know, Big Brother's watching, police state, North Korea, you know, values, alt-right, Breitbart. I don't want to get into a political discussion, but this is ripe.
Yeah, and you can think how prescient this was, because this was written, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s.
So wow.
The fact that, you know, it speaks to somebody at that point.
I might have to borrow the book.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll totally recommend this one.
Okay.
Okay.
Moving on, our next movie then is The Endless, which I'll introduce. And this was interesting in the sense of, you know, I had a couple of choices this afternoon of movies to go to. I ended up selecting this one because the writers and directors, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, were known for creating a little bit of a storm at Tribeca in years past. So in 2014, they released a movie called Spring, which I believe won may have won one of the audience awards. And also a movie in 2012, Tribeca 2012, a movie called Resolution. I looked up the Rotten Tomatoes scores for both movies, with Spring coming in at 90% and Resolution coming in at an almost unheard of 100% positive critic reviews based on their Rotten Tomato review. So I was kind of excited going into this. The basic premise is that after escaping a cult as children, brothers Aaron and Justin are living hand to mouth a decade later, until they receive a mysterious message in the mail that seems to be from their former quote-unquote family. Aaron insists that they go back to investigate, and protective Justin reluctantly agrees, concerned about returning to the place that they worked so hard to leave behind. So all three of us were able to catch this particular movie. I guess, Yazdi, you want to give us your thoughts on The Endless?
I cannot, because I think this movie is not for me. It really is not for me. I mean, I really admire what these two individuals are doing, because I believe one of them wrote the movie, the two of them directed it, and it's a very homegrown affair. I mean, it has some special effects, but you can tell that it was done on the cheap and on the sly. And it has a feeling of somebody very painstakingly having put together the script, even, which is, you know, quite ambitious, if you will, but it just all glazed over me. In fact, yeah, it just glazed over me. I admire it, and I'll leave it at that.
Rashmi.
I really liked it. I have a weird obsession with cults, murderers, street graffiti artists. But cults,
anything you
really
want to confess, Rashmi?
No. Cults really fascinate me. Cults or religions, or just groups of people, and how people end up staying in these things that they know are bad for them. And so this whole idea of two people who have escaped something like that going back to a place which was not good for them is interesting within itself. And then this very interesting thing that something's going on and we don't know quite what's going on. That feeling of Get Out, like it got almost a reminiscent feeling of Get Out at some points. It's not as smart as Get Out by any means. I wish it had been a little bit shorter and a little bit tighter, and then it would have been phenomenal. As it was enjoyable.
Yeah, you know, As I came out of the movie, I found myself just a little puzzled as to how I felt about it. I mean, if I'm honest, I think there are some interesting ideas at play here. And I think it was a very ambitious movie to make on the kind of budget that they clearly made it on. I think, Yazdi, to your point, you know, it shows in several places, you know, the budget was very limited for this kind of, you know, sci-fi-ish, you know, unexplained kind of drama to play out. You know, it's very Twilight Zone-ish in its thinking. Pacing, yeah, was just a little bit off for me as well. I think the movie was definitely too long, but I really did admire the ambition of it all. And I think, again, in terms of concept, I almost want the chance for them to remake this, tighten it up a little bit around the edges, perhaps in the editing room, and, you know, get some serious dollars behind the sci-fi, you know, the special effects budget, because I think the movie kind of necessarily relies on some of those visuals and to explain what it is that is happening. In, you know, that's really the big question the movie poses all the way along is, you know, what is going on and how do we get out of here? and so, you know, not having the visuals to kind of back up the chops of the ideas, I think, was maybe a bit of a distraction during filmmaking. So, again, something I admired from a concept perspective, but perhaps, you know, in the moment I thought was, a little longer than it needed to be. But, you know, I'm curious to see
what they do next.
Their other, and their previous works. Yeah. I mean, it's been almost unbelievably well received in the past. So I'm definitely going to look up those two movies to see if they're available elsewhere, because you just don't see 100% Rotten Tomatoes scores cropping up here and there. And clearly it's no fluke. This movie was one of the most attended press screenings that we've seen this year at Tribeca. Okay, should we move on to our last movie of the day, which is The Son of Sophia? And I'll tell everyone about that. So this movie, again, this is from the International Narrative Competition, and it's coming from Greece, France, and Bulgaria, interestingly. It's directed by Alina Psykou. I think that's how Psykou. She was actually here in the audience, and I believe she's Greek. The basic idea behind this movie is 2 years after his father's death, Misha's mother has created a new life in a new country. After migrating from Russia to Greece, she has found a husband for herself, whose obnoxious attempts at disciplining her son are less than welcome. The movie stars Victor Komut, who was there in the audience. You know what? I'm not even going to go with any of these names because they are from Greece and they have many more syllables than I'm capable of pronouncing in a single sentence, never mind in a single name. So do look up the names. But guys, what did you think of Son of Sophia?
I thought this was a fascinating movie made with a lot of care. I think there's so many themes here to explore that I was almost overwhelmed by it. So there's this whole story of mother and son. There's this whole issue of when is it okay for a mother to take on a new husband and breaking that news to your son and then accepting that unit as a family and aging and who you are and how you go about doing what you want. I mean, there's so many themes in here. I'm kind of overwhelmed at the minute. We just came out of the screening probably about 90 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm still processing it, but I really admire this movie. There's a lot here, and I think this is a very competent filmmaker.
Yazdi?
Yeah, I mean, I think visually the movie is quite something. There's some very deliberate choices in the movie. I mean, the movie is very static and very formal in its presentation. There's nothing fluid about how any of the scenes are staged. They all have a, you know, very kind of a stagey way.
It's almost always using a fixed camera.
It's like always a fixed camera.
On a tripod, in a location, in a room, and the actors move around it.
It's obviously a very deliberate ploy, and it kind of helps, in a way, the whole movie is about isolationism. This little kid, you know, comes to meet his mom, who he hasn't seen in the past several years, and finds out eventually, I'm not giving anything away, but he finds out eventually his mom is married to a much older, you know, Greek man, and they're from Russia. And so he kind of feels very isolated in the surroundings. He doesn't understand the Greek language. He's a little kid, you know, he's trying to understand the world around him. And so I think, you know, how it's presented is rather beautiful. But I think for me, this, I mean, and I've said this many times, coming of age movies are absolutely my favorite genre, but this one didn't get to my heart because I found it a little bit too indulgent. I mean, the director who was there in the audience, she mentioned that she deliberately chose for, you know, the kid and his mom to have a Russian background so that she could set it around the time that the, you know, the Olympics were happening in Athens at that time. And, you know, they would have come from Russia. But there's so much deep diving into Russian music and Russian concepts. And it almost came off a little bit insincere in that regard. But be that as it may, like you said, Rashmi, this story is kind of trying to bite off so much that it's not able to chew it all. I mean, part of it is like Pan's Labyrinth, where there's this kid who can't deal with the world around him. So he imagines these animals and, you know, the kid is necessarily seen as somebody who is very stoic and uncommunicative. And so it's kind of frustrating because you never really understand him. But I guess that's how a kid would be at that stage in life. So it's a very brave thing to do, to have that lead character not be very vocal. So there's a lot to talk about in this movie. So it didn't reach to me at the heart level, but my mind is pretty amazed by it.
Yeah, you know, this is the kind of thing that one gets exposed to at a film festival. You know, the kind of the very different nature of world film, and you know, this is a good example of how storytelling from country to country can differ so much. Because I feel like this movie, you know, is very finely crafted and very deliberately made. It's just I kind of struggled to bond with it in the same way that Yazdi did, in part because I didn't really read it as a coming of age movie. I think a lot of the movie was shot from the boy's perspective, but I also thought it was equally the mother's story, and a lot of it was coming from her perspective and the challenges behind the choices that she had made. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, we have as Western moviegoers is we need to have that attachment to one person,
somebody to latch on
and
to,
go on their journey with them. And I didn't know that this movie was presenting me with that, so I was kind of challenged by that. But it's very
accomplished.
It's complex.
Yeah,
it's layered, and it deals with a lot of different issues. I don't think it does all of them justice necessarily. I think in part of that, which is a shame. I think there's some very unusual imagery in the movie as well. I mean, this whole idea of the various animals. Sometimes they're alive, but sometimes they're also, you know,
sometimes they're masked, like a trippy dream sequence.
And then there's this whole thing towards the end about, you know, the integrity of life, and if somebody is on the deathbed, you know, should you, you know, grant them the ability to, should you relieve them of their pain? It kind of, it's just so many things it's touching on.
Yeah,
and it doesn't really take a position on any of them either. I mean, I think that's partly why, you know, we struggled with it, because there isn't, I think it's kind of just there for, I think, if, you know, it was interesting because there was a direct Q&A at the end of it, and she threw in these other elements that were completely lost on me in terms of the time that the movie was set, which is around the time of the Olympics in Greece, and the way that the country felt. So I think it was a very personal movie, perhaps, if you were Greek and had lived in Greece at that time.
Yeah, but there were also parallels with backstory of these,
the Russian,
the older man being an extra in movies and taking the kid with him, and in some ways it felt like he was going on a journey as well, you know.
But
yeah, and I think one of the audience members in the Q&A mentioned that the movie seemed to deliberately imply this older man as the bad guy initially, because he's created the situation where this woman has to marry him. She's clearly half his age, and you know, this little kid is kind of isolated because of him. But then in the second part of the movie, you slowly start to sympathize with him. And if that was intentional, and she did say that, yes, that was very intentional. So it's interesting you think it's only from the child's perspective, but I almost see it from the, like you said, from the mother's perspective, as well as from this
older man's, who was amazing, by the way. He this was a is great, great amazingly actor. Acted movie.
Yeah, no, I mean, everything about this movie is well done. I mean, I think the writing and direction is superb. It's on a very high level of accomplishment. Same with the performances. Same with the camera work. I mean, it's just a very well put together movie. Just unconventional for those of us that are more used to the traditional Hollywood style narratives, but that doesn't make it not worthy of recommendation. I think if you get the chance to see this movie, you should, because I think it's going to stay with me for a while. I think there's a lot to think about. There are a lot of big moments in this movie that were very challenging in some way, kind of on an intellectual level. It's like, how do I feel about this particular situation, you know, that the mother is in, that the boy is in, that the older man is in? Yeah, it's interesting.
I almost want to watch it again.
Yeah, it feels like there's enough material here for kind of a mini series.
Tomorrow morning, Rashi.
Not that soon, Yazdi. Okay.
You need to let it brew for a while, right?
I think if they play it right, maybe it might have a shot at, you know, the races for best foreign film. I don't know.
Yeah, no, yeah. I that's the thing. I mean, it's there's just so much to it, yeah. And I think, you know, given the option to Tribeca's done this funny thing with voting this year, where you have to vote
online
using an app within minutes of watching a movie, and I think this kind of movie would be a little disadvantaged by that, in part because. I think the way that I feel about it was a little confused, but now that we've stepped away from the movie and we're talking about it, it's kind of climbing up in my admiration.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I feel like if we were to do this podcast again tomorrow, maybe I'll feel a little differently, but this is the last one we watched.
Yeah.
And it was a lot to take in.
It was overwhelming.
Yeah.
And that note.
Terrific stuff. So. Yeah.
So, Rashmi, what was your favorite movie of the day? Oh, and Joe? God. Of the ones you watched.
I think mine is Shadow Man.
Okay.
I'm going to have to say AlphaGo simply because it's right on my wavelength. You know, it's a topic in which I'm interested. 1% More Humid was also
you only
a very
asked for one.
Beautiful movie, but no, AlphaGo was the one that really tickled me in
and
my,
Yassi's was The Endless. My That's why he wanted to ask this question.
No, mine was Sweet Virginia.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Sweet Virginia. Yeah. Yeah.
By a country mile, it sounds
Sweet
like.
Sweet Yassi, yes. Liked Sweet Virginia.
I do. Yeah, it's a great film.
Terrific. Okay. So,
we'll be back on with day three then.
Indeed. That wraps up our coverage for today. Mail at movieworldlers.com, twitter.com/movieworldlers, facebook.com/movieworldlers,
instagram.com/movieworldlers
as well. We're here in New York having some fun. So it is Saturday night for us. It's been an exhausting, kind of grueling couple of days, and we're here for a couple more days, but it is Saturday night, and let's go out and get a bite to eat and then maybe some rest ahead of day three. So until then, too many movies, too little time. Good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.